Hi, this is Farah Osbeck. Welcome back to Military Law and Life Matters, the podcast that arms you with knowledge so you don't become a victim of injustice. So happy to be back again. This is part of my podcast series where I interview lawyers who focus primarily on the military community. Many, but not all the attorneys are former military JAGs and have a passion for helping the military community. So today I'm really happy I'm going to be talking to Ms. Toni O'Neill. Toni is a retired Air Force JAG. She's also a partner at the Parlatori Law Group, which is a cloud-based national law firm. Toni focuses her practice on the representation of military members who are facing adverse actions. She's had enormous success in military courtrooms across all branches of the armed forces, securing acquittal after acquittal for her clients. While she was on active duty with the Air Force, Toni had an unprecedented win rate as an Area Defense Counsel and also as a Senior Defense Counsel. She was regularly placed on the most high-profile and most complex cases in the Air Force. Toni's fearless in the courtroom because that's where she feels most at home, and she's tried over 150 courts martial. That's a lot of cases. Toni's also the mom of two little girls, and an interesting fact I learned about Toni when we were talking is that her dad had taught her how to play poker when she was 5 years old, and during 1 year of law school to earn extra money, she actually was a professional poker player because she attended law school in Las Vegas, so she earned some money there during that 1 year of law school. Today, Toni will talk about her focus, which is military law practice and military courts martial. And I'm going to be introducing Toni to you very shortly.
How are you doing? I'm great. Farah, how are you?
I'm doing really well. And I'm so happy you could join us today. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on our podcast. I'm so excited. And I know that, in talking to you earlier and reviewing your bio, one thing I wanted to highlight to the listeners, because I think it's so cool, is this is the first time I'm interviewing a lawyer who happened to be a former professional poker player, but it was just during law school, right, Toni?
Yeah, I've been playing poker for a long time, or I guess I should say I had been playing poker for a long time. I don't get around to it very often anymore, but when I went to law school, I went to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And when I got there, even though I was on active duty, I was under the extended leave program. So they didn't pay my salary or my tuition. They just let me go to law school. And I found the most, the fastest and easiest way for me to make money to support myself was playing poker. And so that's what I did that year until the Air Force started picking up the bill my second and third years of law school. So that made me a professional poker player that year.
That is awesome. That is just a neat story. I really enjoyed when we were talking about that, learning about that. So Toni, now you have such a very extensive, very expert background doing courts martial, and you have such a very good reputation in terms of your skill in the courtroom. And I already introduced you to the listeners. So I want to now just get into the podcast and ask you some stories and get your expertise. Now, you, as the expert in courts martial defense, can you just tell us the different types of courts martial there are in the armed forces?
Sure. So courts martial is the way that the military adjudicates offenses that military members commit when they're more serious than can be handled by lesser means like administrative reprimands or non-judicial punishment. And they've got three types of court-martial: summary court-martial, special court-martial, and general court-martial. That's kind of going up in severity. A summary court-martial is very minor offenses and has very limited opportunities for punishment, mostly just for enlisted members. And the more junior, the more punishment they can give them. But for a special court-martial, which is kind of the next level up, they've recently over the years split that up into two different types. And one of them is by consent only. So if you consent to being tried by a special court-martial judge alone, then that takes away your ability to request a jury, but it gives you some other protections in the form of the punishment, which is that the judge can't sentence you to be discharged from the military, and they can only sentence you up to 6 months. So a traditional special court-martial allows for punishment up to 12 months of confinement and reductions of rank. reprimands, some other punishments, and then for enlisted members, bad conduct discharge. The highest level of court-martial is a general court-martial, and while the military doesn't have felony or misdemeanor distinctions, it's pretty similar in the fact that a general court-martial handles the more serious offenses and can punish members with significantly more jail time. So it's pretty analogous to a felony level court. And those are the types that you see if you ever see a case, you know, followed by the media. It's usually going to be a general court-martial.
Okay, yeah, for the serious cases, that makes sense. So what are the biggest differences, Tony, between military courts and then civilian courts, for example, like state courts?
So you'll see in the actual parts of the court that would be visible to the public, it's going to look pretty similar. You're going to have a jury sitting there in the court, in a court-martial. We call it the members. We don't call it a jury, but it's the same thing. And you'll have a judge up there. There'll be a prosecutor, a defense counsel, and, you know, the person accused. And you'll do the same sorts of things that you would see in a state court, where with a selection of the jury, opening statements, the examination of witnesses, the prosecution goes first, the defense goes second, and then closing arguments and deliberation. All of that is the same, but basically everything behind the scenes is totally different, starting from, you know, the rights that military members have versus civilian members. So everybody's heard of the Miranda rights. It's from an old Supreme Court case, and in that instance, you have the right to remain silent when you're in custody, and all the other things you hear on Law and Order. In the military, you get even more rights. Even if you're just suspected of a crime, any military member is supposed to read you your rights before they question you. So there's some advanced rights, and then we do provide, or the military does provide, for the expenses involved in a court-martial, like expert witnesses and regular witnesses being traveled, and all of that is covered. That's different than most state courts. One of the biggest differences that you'll see regarding the verdict is that the military is the last place where an American citizen can be convicted with a non-unanimous jury. And so what that means is, even in the military, even if there's somebody sitting on the jury that says, no, that person absolutely is innocent, or the government has absolutely not met their burden beyond a reasonable doubt, that person can still be convicted if they have 3/4 of the members voting guilty. And so, you know, that's a scary proposition, but definitely one of the most important distinctions between military courts martial and civilian courts.
Yeah, that is a huge difference. Are there, you know, people trying to change that?
I think so. I mean, I myself would love to find the perfect case to take that up. Now, unfortunately for, you know, whoever that ends up being, I mean, in order to get a case like that in front of the Supreme Court, somebody's going to have to lose along the way. They're going to have to, you know, be convicted at a court martial, you know, and the problem that people are going to find in bringing one of these cases to the Supreme Court is that there's no polling of the jury. If you've ever seen in a civilian court or on TV in a movie where they kind of go through and they say, we're going to poll the jury, and they ask each jury member how they voted, there, you're not allowed to poll the jury in a courts martial. And so when someone's convicted, you don't actually know whether it was unanimous or not unanimous. And also, the members in a court martial are given explicit instructions from the judge that they usually follow, that says you're not to discuss your vote or anyone else's vote with anybody. And so, you know, the process itself kind of makes it very difficult for anybody to bring one of these challenges, because nobody knows with a conviction whether it was unanimous or not. Mm-hmm. We know that if they followed the rules, it's 3/4 or more, but we don't know whether there was one person on the jury that thought, you know, that voted not guilty, because it's all done by secret written ballot.
Yeah, that's true. So, Tony, speaking of the jury, or in the military, as you reference them, the members, like who are those members in military courts martial?
So you don't get a summons the way that you do in state court to appear and sit in a pool of members. What happens in the military is the commander, it's actually called a convening authority, they they handpick the members. They hand select a group of members to come sit through voir dire, so the process of selecting a jury. And they're supposed to choose those members based on, you know, certain criteria, but they're essentially handpicking military members from their from within their command to go sit on the jury. And then you know, depending on your rank and position as the person accused, you know, the people on the jury, the members are going to outrank you.
Okay. And can you just explain the difference between having enlisted members and officers?
Sure. If you're an enlisted member and you're facing a court-martial, then you have the option of asking for enlisted representation on the panel. So the default for setting a jury is that it's a panel of officers. And if you're enlisted, if you're officers, you're stuck with officers. You can't have enlisted members on your panel. But if you are enlisted, you can request, and it will be honored, that your jury be comprised of at least one-third members. Those members will be enlisted members, and those members will outrank you and they will not come from your unit.
Okay. All right. So the member that the accused, as we say in the court martial, the accused has a right then to choose whether they want to go with members or a judge. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's one of the decisions that the accused gets to decide on their own, that they have to make that call by themselves. So, you know, when you hire a lawyer or you're appointed a lawyer, you know, who's a military defense attorney, the lawyer is going to make a whole bunch of decisions. You know, they're going to bring motions on your behalf. They're going to question witnesses. They're going to interview witnesses ahead of time. There's a lot of things that the lawyer's going to do essentially without, you know, necessarily running it by the person who's accused, because there's just too many decisions to be made. But there are four big decisions that only the accused can make. And so their lawyer will give them advice on what they think they should do for those four things. But those are their decisions to make alone. And those things are, first, who their lawyer is, who represents them. Number two, whether they plead guilty or not guilty. Number three, whether they testify or not. And number four, whether they go with a judge or a jury. Back to your question about what some of the biggest differences are between the military and the state courts, I would say one of the biggest differences is with pleading guilty. What you see a lot and you hear about a lot in the civilian world is that people take plea bargains. So, you know, they're charged with one crime and their lawyer talks with the prosecutor who offers a great deal and they take it. And then they say, oh, I had to take a deal, even though I didn't do anything wrong, because my lawyer said I was going to go to jail for a long time. And, you know, there's a lot of problems with plea bargains out in the civilian world. But in the military, you can't just take a deal. In order to plead guilty in the military, you have to actually be guilty, because you will be put under oath by the military judge and they will ask you questions, and you have to give details as to why you're guilty, you know, exactly what you did, how you did it, why you did it. And the judge is going to ask you all of those questions, and you have to satisfy the judge that you are in fact guilty of the offense in order to plead guilty to it. So that's a huge difference between the military and the civilian world.
Yeah, that I'm so glad you brought that up, because I you know, get calls sometimes from people saying that, you know, when I don't do them anymore, but the discharge upgrades, or, you know, they were court-martialed and maybe didn't get a BCD and they got a, you know, a bad discharge. So they would say, well, I was court-martialed, but I wasn't guilty. I just pled guilty. And then I would go back to, well, that's going to be a hard case to overturn, because there was a care inquiry. Do you remember when the judge was asking you like a million questions, right? About the elements. So I always have to go through that. It's because they think, you know, yeah, in the civilian world, it's so, so different, right? You just plead because they might not be guilty, but don't want to face like 70 years in jail. But in the military, I just explained that's so hard to overcome, because, you know, they have a court-martial record or trial where you answer these questions. So anyway, yeah, I'm so glad you brought up that distinction. It's very difficult in the military. Yeah, they will cross-examine you to make sure, right, the judge, that you are guilty.
Right.
And so regarding, you know, you said the different rights they have. Regarding a client, what's your strategy, or how do you discuss with a client whether they should testify or not testify? I know that's one of the things you will talk to your client about, right?
Yeah. So that's one of the decisions that they have to make. I mean, most of the cases, if not virtually all the cases that I try now as a civilian defense counsel, the, you know, the person is calling me because they want to plead not guilty. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately for me, a lot of my clients are actually innocent of what they've been charged with, which is, you know, a very humbling experience that is very stressful for the attorney, but to sit next to an innocent man and, you know, a discussion that we will have, you know, sometimes multiple times throughout the months leading up to trial is whether or not they want to testify. I put a lot of clients on the stand. That's unusual. It doesn't happen very often. I mean, I am exposing my clients to cross-examination when I advise them to make that decision to testify. But, you know, I feel like I prepare my clients to do that, and that it is very hard for the prosecution to get beyond a reasonable doubt when somebody takes the stand under oath and says, I didn't do it. So if my client's able to do that, if they're able to, you know, swear under oath that they did not commit the offenses they're charged with, then I want them to do that if they can. Some of them, you know, for strategic reasons, they don't, you know, the government has not proven their case, so we're not going to bother, or, you know, there's some minor misconduct in their past that will be allowed to be, you know, cross-examined on, which could make the jury think poorly of them. I mean, all of that is strategy that comes into the decision whether to testify or not. But I do like to put my clients on the stand, and I use my clients in preparing for the trial because they more often than not know a lot about what happened, and they can tell me, you know, they're a valuable resource. And so, you know, I do, you know, get their help in developing strategy and my game plan for the trial.
Okay. Yeah. That's, and I know you have done like so many, over 150 trials, I believe. Right.
Yeah. And yeah, most of them litigated. Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of trials. I have not done nearly as many trials as you. Do you want to talk through any highlights you want to talk about for a typical case? Like what happens before the trial, during the trial, after? Is there anything you want to highlight to the listeners regarding the trials itself?
Sure. So, you know, any case that's going to make it to court martial is going to begin with an investigation. So someone makes an allegation and there's an investigation. If it's the type of case that typically ends with a court martial after the investigation, that's usually going to be handled by the Office of Special Investigations for the Air Force, OSI, or NCIS for the Navy and the Marine Corps, or CID for the Army. And so what happens is they are doing their investigation, and sometimes the member knows they're under investigation, and so they can hire their own attorney at that point. Sometimes they don't know until they get called in for questioning themselves, which is usually towards the end of the investigation. And, you know, at that point, they know that they're under investigation. They've been read their rights as to what they're under investigation for, and they've either talked to the investigators or they haven't. But that's the stage, if not before, that they need an attorney. And, you know, I have found in my practice that that's a very valuable stage to get representation, because there are things that can be done sometimes in some cases early on to even prevent a court-martial from happening. Certainly not always, you know, the facts are what they are. The allegation is what it is. In some cases are always going to go forward. But I have had a lot of experiences lately, in the last couple of years, especially, where, you know, I'm only taking on a certain number of clients under investigation because I expect that they'll go to a court-martial and I don't want to get too busy. And so I take on a limited number of clients, and my investigation clients keep not going to court martial. They keep the cases keep ending, the investigation ends, and they don't pursue it any further. And a lot of that is because of things we're able to do to shape the investigation from the outside. We're able to point the investigators to people that can provide helpful information. Sometimes we're able to provide text messages or other information that the investigators don't have, and we can provide that early on, and it's so powerful it can, you know, turn a case off. And, you know, so you never know what there is that can be done unless you try it. And so there's never any harm in, you know, in working on that strategy early on. But once an investigation closes out and a case goes to court martial, there's lots of steps that happen there. Strategy develops and motions can really shape the battlefield of what the case is going to look like. And that's, you know, another area in which having an experienced counsel that's seen a lot of cases and the way they play out can be beneficial.
Okay. When we're discussing the, you know, testifying, one thing regarding before you said the investigation, and I know it's due to your talent and expertise that you know, these cases, they don't go to trial. It's because the client was smart enough to hire someone like you. But one question I wanted to kind of dispel, because I get questions like this from when I talk to people, for example, even if it's not a court martial, a CDI, they get called in and I'm like, did you make a statement? And they're like, yeah, I didn't, you know, I'm innocent. So I talked to them. But can you like dispel, like, is there any time, Tony, that someone should ever, when you read your rights in the military specifically, and probably civilian too, that you should just alone, just, yeah, I'm just, and talk to the investigators? Would you ever recommend that to anyone?
I really can't think of a case in which that's going to be the right answer. I wouldn't do it myself. I mean, if I was called in with as much experience as I have, mm-hmm. and I was called in to OSI or NCIS, and I was questioned about an offense that I knew I didn't commit, like, I still don't think I'd talk to them. And there's a scene. What is that show with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson? True Detective, where he's sitting there and he's being questioned and he says, you know, I'll talk to you if you get me a pizza. I'll talk to you if you get me a beer. I might play that game, but I'm not actually going to talk to them, because the problem isn't with what you said. You may say the same thing if you testify under oath later. The problem is with the miscommunication that is always going to occur in that stressful situation. The agent is going to ask you a question you don't fully understand, and you're answering a question like that wasn't asked, or the agent misunderstands what you said, or it could be something as simple as the agent asked you where you were on Monday and you just instinctively think of two Mondays ago because you forget that today's Tuesday and you're answering the question. And now it looks like you're lying, you know, and it can be interpreted badly later. There's just so many things that can go wrong. And there's, I can't think of a good reason not to confer with a lawyer before talking, if you're going to talk at all.
Yeah, I can't either. And I tell them, because they feel they're going to be, especially like an officer, unprofessional. People are going to think I'm guilty, you know, it's, and they just don't get it. Like, no.
They tell you that. They feel that way because not just because of the internal pressure to participate and comply. It's also because they tell you that. And the thing is, they're allowed to lie to you. And
Yeah. Explain that, Tony, because I know we were earlier talking about that issue, about that they're allowed to. You know, they're doing their job. So we're not criticizing the investigators. They're doing their job. But how is it they can lie to you? What can they say?
Yeah, they're allowed to lie to you in just a lot of different ways. They can tell you that this is your one chance to talk. If you tell us now, we can help you out. If you tell us what happened, we will go to your command and, you know, we will put in that word for you so that you don't get in any trouble. And all of that is just garbage. It's not true at all. Number one, there's always another chance. You can come back later and tell them what happened. If you want to, they're going to listen to you. They always want your side of the story.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's never, this is your only chance. They're not going to help you. That is not their job. And they just simply don't. But they can also lie to you and tell you that things exist that don't exist, and it can really twist somebody up. You know, even somebody who didn't do anything wrong, if you're told, well, we have you on tape at this location at this time, then you can start thinking, well, did I go there? Did I not go there? And a lot of people talk out loud when they're thinking. They think out loud.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, they're going through their own thought process. Sometimes they're saying it out loud. And, it can just look bad, even a completely innocent person. And I just can't think of a good reason why you'd want to do that unrepresented.
Yeah. I think you dispelled them. I mean, that all these examples, and you know, they're doing their job. They can lie to you and say, we saw, you know, there's two witnesses. We have already recorded statement and set a sworn statement saying they were with you when you used cocaine or something. And if the person did use it, they're going to be like, okay, they got me. Let me make a statement and let them put a good package together for me, for my commander, which is what they say. You know, we'll put a good old recommendation for the commander. So yeah.
And they don't do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, obviously, yeah, that's not going to determine whether the guy goes to court or not. At the trial, right? A guilty plea, whatever, they might get something for that. But yeah, so I'm glad you explained that. There's no question about that. So that's, we discussed that. So yeah, ask for a lawyer. It doesn't mean you're unprofessional. So I'm glad you discussed that. So how about anything else regarding the trial, like after you, so that was before, during, anything else regarding the trial process you want to discuss?
I mean, I take trial strategy from like a broader view. Like there is a bit of theater involved in a court martial, and you have to think of what every thing that you are doing along the way, how it looks to the members. You know, if you have a jury, if you have members, you need to be thinking about how it looks to them. I mean, you have to do the same for a judge, but to a lesser extent. But it's kind of like the movie A Few Good Men, where Demi Moore objects and you see Tom Cruise's character get very upset that she's objected. And it's not because her objection was bad. It's not because she didn't have a good reason, or maybe she should have even, you know, had that objection sustained. It's because of how it looked to the members and how that looked like there was a crisis. And so there's a lot of strategy that goes into, you know, how you are kind of presenting your case to the members. And it can be as simple as what your client is doing when they're sitting next to you, what your client's doing when, you know, certain people are testifying, you know, what you're doing, you know, as well as what you say and what you don't say is even more important, you know, and knowing when not to ask, you know, that last question, you know, when to leave that, you know, kind of hanging in the air. There's just a lot of strategy that is involved in trial work. And if you can, you know, if you can see the forest through the trees, you know, you can really set yourself up for, you know, for a lot of success.
Yeah, that was a good movie. I like that. It was pretty, very entertaining, but also good. A Few Good Men. I don't remember when that came out, a long time ago, but it was pretty pop. It was a good. Yeah. I know Tom Cruise. He was good in that movie. But Tony, my favorite like law movie though is My Cousin Vinny. Have you seen that?
I have seen that so many times. It would be embarrassing to tell you how many. It's one of my favorites.
I love that movie. Just it's just every time I see it, it makes me laugh. So, so Tony, regarding all the trials you've done, is there any, I'm sure there's some war story or one trial that maybe, is there anything that sticks out you can share with the members? I mean, you know, trials are public, right? They're public records. So you're not revealing anything and you're not going to tell the name, but is any story or anything, a war story from a trial that you can share with the member, with the, I keep saying the members, our listeners.
The listeners, yeah. So I have a lot, you know, and over cocktails, I'm sure I could talk for hours and hours over, you know, all of the cases that I've done, but there is one that kind of comes to mind, and I tell the story often just because it's kind of funny. But I talked about how I put my clients up on the stand a lot, and I do prepare them ahead of time. You know, we talk about what they're going to say. We kind of prepare over the months leading up to trial, but right before, you know, the night before or the week of, you know, we'll sit down and we'll do some question and answer and see how they're doing and try to get the nerves out. But in one particular case, I put my client up on the stand. He was accused of sexual assault, and our defense was that sex had occurred, but it was consensual sex. And so I put my client up on the stand, and I'll just make up names. And he was a staff sergeant. So I get him up there and I say, you know, Staff Sergeant Jones, do you know Airman Smith? And he says, yes, ma'am, I do. I said, Staff Sergeant Jones, did you have sex with Airman Smith? Yes, ma'am, I did. And Staff Sergeant Jones, did you rape Airman Smith? And he says, yes, ma'am, I did. And I stood there in the middle of the courtroom. I'm sure my face, you know, was completely flushed. And I immediately, I mean, as fast as I could, I said, you know, Sergeant Jones, I know that you're nervous, but you need to calm down, listen to what I'm saying, and answer the question I'm going to ask you again. And I said, you know, Sergeant Jones, did you rape Airman Smith? And he said, no, ma'am, I did not. And
Oh my God.
It went much better from there. You know, he did actually do very well testifying. And I think the members knew, you know, everybody knew that he had made a mistake. But when I was preparing for final arguments for closings with the experts that were on our case and my co-counsel the night before, you know, one of them asked, they said, is the prosecutor going to bring that up in their closing argument? And everybody started saying, oh no, they never would. That would look so bad. Everybody knows it was a mistake. And I said, nope, they're going to bring it up. It's coming. And they did. So the next morning when we had closing arguments and they brought it up, there was a chief master sergeant. It was an enlisted and officer panel, a chief master sergeant on the panel in the jury sitting in the front row. And as soon as the prosecutor brought that up and called it a Freudian slip, he threw his pencil up in the air and leaned back and just had no more patience for that prosecutor. So, I mean, at that point, you know, I felt pretty good about the case and about my closing argument, but I definitely knew I had that chief on my side. So, you know, the case went well. The jury came back in, I don't know, maybe about a half an hour with a not guilty verdict. But, you know, that moment when my client, you know, had that little slip up was definitely one of the most heart stabbing moments of my career.
Wow. That's you. That was quick thinking on your part. I don't know what I would have done. Like, imagine if someone else, not you, would have said, I need a 30, you know, like a 39A session or something to like regroup and talk. But you were really, I think you handled it beautifully by just like re-asking him, knowing he's, you know, just made a mistake, was so nervous. And because if you did take a break, maybe it would have not worked in your favor. So, wow, that is yeah, I was nervous listening to you talk about that. I was like, oh my God. So, and it worked well. You love it when the jury gets annoyed with the prosecutor, when your defense counsel, don't you? It's great. It's great when they don't like what they do. So that was a great story. I'm glad. So he was acquitted.
Yeah.
That's great. So Tony, you know, to wrap this up, the name of the podcast is Military Law and Life Matters. And as we know, anything in military law that's affecting you, if you're undergoing, you know, some type of criminal action or something, it affects life matters. Is there some type of tip or some life lesson you could share with our listeners of things they should maybe know if they're facing, you know, something like this? What's something good you could tell them?
So I would say ask for help early. So, I mean, and I think that's just as important in regular life as it is in criminal law or in military, you know, law and courts martial. But, you know, the saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I mean, it's absolutely true. If you get the right people, the right experts involved early, you know, you can really change the direction of where something is going, and you can, you know, shape the outcome, and you have a lot more control when you do it that way. And so, you know, I just say, you know, memories can get, you know, can be lost over time. Evidence can be lost. I mean, a lot of things today are on our phone. They're, you know, they're in messages and various apps. And the sooner we know to start looking for that stuff, you know, the better. I had a case where one of the charges turned on, you know, what was captured on somebody's Google Home device. And so, you know, we wouldn't have that if we hadn't thought to look for it early on, because, you know, things are only kept for so long. So the earlier you get advice, start talking strategy, you know, the better. And I think that goes in life too. I mean, you know, you don't want to let something go for a long time when you could solve the problem earlier, because it just festers and gets worse.
That is great advice. You're right. It, not only for if you're under investigation or, you know, that type of issue, but any matter. Yeah. You want to, I always say, like, you know, the problem's not going to go away if you ignore it. So that is perfect advice and a perfect way to end this. Tony, I so, so enjoyed talking to you. It's obvious you are one talented attorney and so knowledgeable. I'm so happy you were able to take the time to talk to us and talk to and present all this information for military members. Hopefully they'll never need to call you, but we all learned a lot, you know, just listening to what you had to say. So, but it was just a pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much, Tony. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Farah. This was really fun. I appreciate what you're doing for people out there. I really enjoy, you know, listening to your podcast, and I hope we reach a lot of people with this.
Yes. Yeah, I hope so. All right. Take care, Tony. We'll talk to you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right.
Well, I love that conversation with Toni O'Neill. She had a wealth of information that she shared with us. I really enjoyed listening to her war story and the great advice she gave all around about courts martial, your rights, Article 31 rights. It's just full of a lot of information that I hope, you know, it sticks with you. Listen to it a couple of times to and follow her advice. I think it was all very good advice. She's an expert in the criminal law arena, courts martial. And, you know, one of the big takeaways from that podcast is the importance. She stressed the importance of retaining an attorney, consulting with one early on. Like, don't wait until you're called in by your commander and he starts reading you the court martial charges he's preferring against you. If once you know you're under investigation, it's really important to seek counsel. You know, you really need to talk to someone to give you advice on what to do. And, you know, most importantly, even what not to do, because a lot of people just do the wrong things. As you know, we discussed this whole topic with her of like going and running and going to the OSI, the investigators, and, you know, trying to like say all this stuff thinking it's going to help you because you think, well, I'm innocent, I have nothing to hide. Well, that's the wrong answer. So listen to the podcast again if you have any confusion about that. But yeah, so she gave a lot of really great advice. And, you know, regardless of the issue, I've always said during these little attorney podcasts that it's really good to get an expert opinion if you have any type of legal issue in your life, because that attorney is going to give you insight, you know, things to do, what not to do, how to solve your problem, because ignoring a problem is not going to make it go away. It's just going to cause you stress every day. Like, okay, what am I supposed to do? So, you know, confronting it is going to actually give you, you know, probably ease your burden, and talking to someone who understands the situation, perhaps ease the burden as to what's, you know, what to expect. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's my advice to you, you know, just confront the issue and talk to someone who can give you advice. Okay. Off to my other topic that I'd like to end these with as well is, you know, I'd like to have more people, hopefully the military community, be aware of this podcast. So I'd really appreciate if you share these. I'll be like sharing them on LinkedIn and Twitter, etc. But please share it with the community, because there'll be topics interesting, you know, all different types of topics that, you know, even if you're not in the military, if you're a veteran or, you know, doing something, some of the topics will be interesting and could help you, things you know, you could learn about, whether it's like, you know, you get called in to make a statement by a civilian investigator or other issues. We're not, you know, just doing criminal law. We'll have a lot of different types of legal issues on the podcast. So basically what I'm trying to do is please spread the word, spread the podcast. If you can, go on iTunes, give it a 5-star rating if you can. If you want, you could write a comment as well. That would help. But share it with people. And I hope, you know, more and more people are aware of this podcast that I've had for several years. I haven't been as consistent, but I'm hoping to do a bunch of these attorney interviews because it's just giving me a great chance of learning about areas of law that I'm not familiar with as well. So, yeah. And as I always end my podcast, please never, ever give up, because there is always hope. And I look forward to talking to you next time. Take care.